And so last week we were talking about not managing difficult material, whether it's cosmic or karmic. And we'd started with a koan that Joan had mentioned in one of our talks, where the student comes to the teacher and asks, when the heat and the cold come in a time of heat and a time of cold, how can they be avoided? And the teacher says, go to the place where there is no heat or cold, which sounds a lot like a kind of ultimate calm or tranquility where nothing impinges on you. And I think the student takes it that way and says somewhat hopefully, so how do I go to the place where there's no heat and cold? And the response is, in a time of cold, let the cold kill you. In a time of heat, let the heat kill you. Just let that all that material wash over you. And so we'd mostly talked about the kind of Dharmakaya emptiness koans, where we're dealing with, I guess, a kind of cosmic, gigantic quality that washes over you, and you have no recourse, no defense against the cosmos, finally. And then we were going to turn this week, which I'll do in a minute, to a related way of sitting with a particular karmic material. I wanted to go back to one thing that happened last time, though, because I was listening to the recording just to see where we were and so on. And so there's a great thing that turns up a lot of the times in the koans. Teachers will say each statement returns to the self. So one of the other Dharmakaya koans we mentioned was this one. The student comes to Dasui and says, I know that at the end of the kalpa, a fire will completely destroy the universe. I'm still not clear whether there's something that won't be destroyed. And Dasui says, it will be destroyed. And then the student asks again, as if he, you know, wants to poke it again and see if he can get a different answer out of the slot machine, you know. So it'll follow along with it, really. And Dasui says, yes, it'll follow along with it. So I was listening to the transcript, and instead of reading the koan correctly, the sort of earlier part where the student asks, I'm still not clear whether there's something that will be destroyed. And the answer, of course, is it will be destroyed. And I said, it will not be destroyed. So if you think you're done, if I think I'm done being the student who's grasping on in some way to that question, you know, are you sure there isn't something that won't be destroyed? I'm not. There's a great moment in the cantos where Ezra Pound says, oh, you who think you will get through hell in a hurry. So none of us will probably get through our own particular hell in a hurry. That comes nicely to hand, though, actually, because in a couple ways. So one way is that if there's a part of me or a part of anyone of us who wants to poke it and say, you know, are you sure there's something that won't be destroyed, that's okay. And maybe through practice, there's another part that's willing to say with Dasui, it will be destroyed. And I think the way to work with that or sit with it, which really fits in with what we've been saying, is that we don't try to beat out of us that part of us that says, the part of us that would mistakenly say with the teacher, it will not be destroyed, but just to acknowledge that, to sit with it, and let those two things kind of settle next to each other. Oh, please, you know, it won't be destroyed. It will be destroyed. And that sitting with those two for however long it takes will let something sort itself out. And it will never mean, I think, at least in my experience, that little voice that says, you sure I'm really gonna die? Yeah, that's never really gonna go away. And that's fine, I think. All right, so I wanna turn to the kind of karmic material. And I think the only tradition I've really sat in is ours, the Pacific Zen School that comes through John and Joan. So I'm not sure how unusual this is, but our way is really when that material wants to come and grab us, that we say, okay, I'll sit with it for a while. Even if I thought I was working on something grand and cosmic and spiritual, I'm prepared to do that at any moment. So in terms of where that fits or doesn't fit in the tradition, I just want to say a little bit by way of background. And again, I'm not sure this is the only way to tell the story, but there are one or two moments where Robert Aiken, who's the founder of the Diamond Sangha and John Terence teacher, says Just for example, somebody will come to me after a long retreat or at the end of the last interview, and I'll ask, how was the retreat for you? And the person will say, it's great. You know, I really worked on this problem and really worked it out. And it could be, you know, what to invest in the stock market, but it might well be, you know, I'm feeling miserable about my relation to my, you know, dead father or something like that, but I finally got clear on it. And Aiken says in a kind of fairly dour way, he says, I know when the student tells me that they actually didn't have a good retreat because they're not supposed to be sitting with that kind of material. They're supposed to be working on the koan. I think there must be another side to Aiken's teaching, but at least in some moments there's an emphasis on, you know, put everything else out of your mind except the focus on this kind of deep cosmic material in some way. So John Terence says in some place, talking about a passage like this or interactions with Aiken that were like this, he says, it was very, very important that my teacher told me that, and it was really important that I disobeyed my teacher. So our neck of the woods really is interested in being available to those difficulties when they turn up. And in my experience, they're more likely to turn up in a long retreat than in a half-hour sit, though anything is possible. But it's a pretty common thing that at least one of the days in a 5 or 6 day retreat, you're going to spend a lot of the time sitting with not what you think you came for, but with something else that you thought you came to escape, and it will come up and get you for sure. So one of the ways that Joan has talked about that, I remember one particular retreat where this was part of an opening talk, she said, if you brought something like that, that's great. You know, if there's material that's causing you pain, if there's something difficult that's recalcitrant, you don't know how to deal with it, it's great that you brought it. But what I invite you to do is for the week, you put it in the center of the room. And I think one of the things that meant is that you kind of let the retreat or the process take care of it. It also seems to imply, don't deal with it for all, sort of put it in the middle and stay where you are. At the same time, though, it's a very common thing, at least in my experience, to go into her during a work in the room during retreat, and you talk about something that's really kind of come to get you. And she'll often say, well, if that's really coming to get you, why don't you just lean into it for a while? And she always had this unerring ability to say that just when you didn't want to hear it. You know, it's like, what you wanted to hear is, no, it's a retreat, go back to working on your code. So, oh, just, you know, so, well, I think I better do that. So in some way, there's this odd combination of leaning into it and letting it be present and, you know, let it come to meet you, while also somehow putting it in the center of the room, putting in this big space that's also the space of the retreat, that's also the space of the vastness, the silence, and the stillness. And I think in some way what's being suggested is that there's a way to be with that material the same way we are with the koan, without trying to sort of work on it and solve it. And so paradoxically, I think, even though that's the kind of material that at least sometimes, ultimately, we want to find a way to come to terms with, and often we think there's something that we need to do about a particular situation, I think the particular or peculiar way that we work on it within our practice, at least initially, is to not try to manage it. Sometimes it will be material that really isn't manageable, that there's nothing you can do about it. Other times it may be material, ultimately, that you do want to manage, or you think there might be a way to manage it. But I think our way with it is to sit with it the way we would with the koan. And so one of the ways we do that, just in terms of a kind of practical level, is we can often just ask, you know, what is this? And that's not really an invitation so much to say, well, what's the history of it and how can I, you know, make propositions about it? But it's really an invitation to quiet down with it, and very often, though not always, just to feel it somewhere in your body and let it be there as whatever it is, and just gently to ask, what is this? And sometimes a narrative will come, sometimes a grievance will come, and then I think again we just let it sink into the body, at least for a lot of the time that we're doing that. So probably everybody's got a different range of experiences trying to work with material like this, but I'll share some of mine, and they may at least overlap with what's happened or what may happen to other people. One of the things that can happen, John Terence says, I think really nicely, he says it's really hard to give something up, but you know, so it's, oh, I'm angry about this, or this is really unresolved for me, and I, you know, so it's really hard to say, I'm going to be done with that. But he says, sometimes it'll give you up, which is really nice. You know, if you don't try to push it away, sometimes it'll just be done with you. And one of the interesting things, and Jonah's talked about this a few times, is that you may not realize until it happens that it was ready to happen. So you sit down with something that's troubling you, and you sit with it for a while, you don't try to fend it off, and it's really, it doesn't have the sting, it doesn't have the bite, it doesn't have the intensity that it used to. If I want to, I can work myself up into getting involved in that, but actually, really, I could just let it go. And so there's some material that really is ready to give you up, and sitting with it on the cushion is sometimes a great way to realize that. Another thing that might happen, and this is, I'll go here by way of an analogy to something else that John said. I think we actually talked about this one or two times ago. John used to say that if you're sitting in a long retreat and you're experiencing a lot of physical pain in your knees, for example, that one of the things you can do is just focus on that area of your body without really trying to do anything, just to pay attention to it. And if you pay attention with the kind of curiosity, you may learn a few things about that pain. So you'd say, for example, one of the things you'll learn is that the pain in your knee actually has boundaries. You know, you can sort of move out from the center of it kind of to the edges, and then you'll notice a place where actually that part really isn't in pain. And then all kinds of other things, you might note that it comes and it goes, it pulsates, the intensity of it moves around, the more you tense up, the worse it is, or whatever. The caveat would be, just as an aside, that one of the things that used to be said to us was if you did that, it was also a pretty good way of knowing whether the pain was potentially physically dangerous. And that turned out not to be accurate in a couple cases that I could remember. So you could say to yourself, actually, I'm pretty sure this, you know, and then you'd blow your knee out and that was too bad. So I wouldn't really take it literally in that sense, in terms of, you know, riding it all the way to the end. But I do think, by way of analogy, if you're dealing with recalcitrant emotional material or something that's difficult, you may find that also, that, you know, it's pretty intense here, but it isn't the whole country. It isn't the whole terrain. It's kind of local. There's another place where you can notice that you feel fine, or it's somewhat attenuated or something like that. And so in some way, it may put it in a kind of perspective. Another thing that happens sometimes, I think, is that you'll notice that what you're feeling is attached maybe to a particular story that you're telling about the situation. And sometimes the longer you sit with that story, maybe the less true it seems, or maybe it's just a story that you're telling yourself, but over here there's this other part that's just the feeling that isn't part of the story, or whatever. In any case, I think what happens sometimes is that a different story or a different truth about the situation really comes up from underneath that, and in some sense can really replace the first story that you were telling. You can see that there's something, you know, not accurate about that story. You can see that on a deeper level, there's something else that you're feeling that's truer than the first thing you were feeling. There are a couple of moments in Freud where he talks about this sort of particular sort of ghastly quality of repressed material as being sometimes just a function of the repression, that actually the energy to fend it off or not to see something else gives the memory or the material a kind of horrific situation. And as you let some of that material in, the horrific quality can kind of dissolve. So that's certainly something that can happen. It's like you walk into the retreat with one story about a situation, and partly because of your commitment to that story, you're deeply committed to the affect that seems to go along with it, and sometimes that will really transform. Another thing that might happen that's in some way analogous to the it will be destroyed, it won't be destroyed, is you may not need to, or it may not be accurate to give up that one range of feelings in that one story, but another one may come up alongside it. And so you may say, well, this is true, and that's also true. You may also you may wander into a place where you say, I have no idea which is true, so I have to hold them both provisionally. And that's in some way a kind of shift in the material. I think it's also true, you know, to go back to sort of John and Robert Aiken and that story, whether it actually happened or not, sometimes, strangely enough, the amount of time you spend not trying to manage the material will lead you to a place where all of a sudden you say, oh, it's manageable, I know how to manage it. And you can walk out and do that. And I think a lot of that happens. It's, I mean, one of the questions that's lurking here is, what's the relation between meditation and Zen meditation and therapy? And I think there are a bazillion ways to answer that for a bazillion different situations. But in my experience, there's something that happens sitting with material that somebody might otherwise have dealt with in a therapy situation, and sitting with it in that big space, in that vast silence, in that odd kind of terrain where you're very willing to say this is true and the opposite is also true, that in some of the ways I've been describing, and I'm sure in other ways as well, important shifts and sometimes resolutions can happen with that material. So here's a sort of escape hatch or a caveat of a different kind. My wife Linda used to like to read to me sometimes from, it's Miss Manners, right? She died a long time ago, the columnist. And there's one that I remember the punchline, though I'm sure I'll get the actual story, but it's something like somebody's got this grievance and writes to Miss Manners because they were at a conference or something like that, and they were in a hotel with a couple people, and the person with the grievance who's writing Miss Manners turned to somebody else in the elevator, let's say, and started to strike up a nice conversation, and the other person really didn't respond. It just sort of made light of it. And Miss Manners said, well, you know, not everyone wants to make new friends all the time. So I think you get to do that when you're sitting. You know, it's something may come to you and you can say, not everyone wants to make new friends all the time. So it's really your choice. Usually, I mean, sometimes you feel like you don't have a choice, but often it's your choice. You know, I'll deal with this now. I won't deal with it. I'll wait for later. I'll deal with it for a little while, but actually it's too terrible and I'm going to not deal with it. And one of the questions would be, if you decide that, how do you make that happen? You know, how do you not deal with it? And I don't think I have any infallible answer at all. But I mean, one thing you can do is go back to a different kind of practice. You can start counting your breath again. You know, another thing you can do in terms of body sensations, sometimes if it's kind of turbulent material, you really will feel it around your heart or around your chest. So I don't think that metaphor of the heart for feeling is completely accidental. You know, there it is in some way. And you can try to drop your breathing down to your hara as one way of dealing with it. I think another good solution sometimes, though I wouldn't recommend it in general, is say, I'm not going to sit anymore today. You know, so that's enough. I just can't do this. And I think a lot of us have had at least the related experience of processing pretty hard material in the hall during a retreat. And then you just go back after lunch during the break and you just go to sleep as deeply as you can until the bell rings. And then you try to have the energy and the courage or, you know, the fortitude to sit with the material again. One other thing I want to stress, I guess, is that at least in my experience, and I say this all the time, I know, but it would seem that when you're dealing with that kind of material, the kind of experiences that you think you came to the retreat for feel like they're a bazillion miles away. You know, oh, I thought I was going to get enlightened. Oh, I thought I was going to be incredibly calm. And I'm really upset about this material. It's a really difficult retreat. It's very often the case that there's a kind of purgative, cathartic quality to doing that. And in the very next moment, you may be having the deepest retreat that you've ever had. And you may be right in the middle of emptiness. So I want to close by just coming back really quickly to some of the Dharmakaya stuff. And where I left that last time was by saying that, you know, you sit with the material, you don't try to manage it, you sit with those big koans that confront you really with the vastness and emptiness and stillness, and you don't try to wangle them. The promise of the tradition is that if you do that, at some point, something else in a very, very powerful and dramatic way can and probably will be there for you as well. So one experience, you know, is just, oh, I don't feel like there's any radiant light, but this completely mysterious darkness that I'm sitting in is already peaceful and already enough. And Joan's talked a lot about that the last couple of years with the stuff on the lunar dharma. It can also, that sort of nothing phase, be really disconcerting. And so we mentioned last time Hakuin saying the whole universe was sheer darkness, or Linji saying it was like an ice cave a million miles thick. So to be there is not always the most comfortable or comforting thing. And again, just to keep to the same thing, I think to the extent you can, you don't try and turn that into anything else, you just stay with it. And as with all other kinds of things, many other kinds of things in our practice, you don't have to make the next thing happen. At some point, something else will happen. And so it's not an accident that Shito Shichen, in taking part in the gathering, says branches of light stream from that dark. So that's, again, part of the promise of the tradition. And I guess that's where I'll leave it. So thank you very much. We have just a little bit of time for comments, questions, talk of any kind.
It amazes me how much I forget, you know, just the acceptance of, oh yeah, this is okay, and that's okay, and that's okay, you know, as you're talking about, you know, sort of this is the way in our tradition that, you know, sit with this and this, and there they are, and it's just so natural to not do that.
Yeah, for sure.
To pick one and say it's good or bad, and the other one and say it's good or bad.
Yeah. I think that for me too, for sure. One of the things by Joan that I've been listening to recently puts a particular spin on it, and I think we all have a almost ineradicable tendency to think of spiritual practice as a self-improvement project, and therefore, and some of this is good, but it can also be really bad, to kind of examine ourselves rigorously. And so it's a little bit of a digression, but I remember Joan saying to me one time that the strength of your practice is right next to what the problem is. And she said, and I know I'm kind of hyper-conscious, she says, the strength of it is that you notice everything that's going on in your mind. And she said, the problem is you have an opinion about all of it, you know? So the trick is in some way to sort of notice all that stuff and try to be a little less opinionated about it. And one of the ways to do that is, to the extent that Zen is a self-improvement project, which it isn't, but it is for all of us, you know, we keep falling into that, it's impossible not to score yourself. And if you're scoring yourself, it's impossible not to be irritated that you had a certain reaction to something which wasn't sufficiently spiritual. And if you're irritated by it, it's really hard not to fall into that and make that the whole story. And so again, Joan's antidote is, that's what you're feeling, and it's a very small part of a really big situation, even if it's just an interpersonal situation. What you're feeling at a particular moment is maybe not a tiny part, but it's not the whole field of what's going on. And to the extent that you get into that thing, you know, nothing else matters in this situation, but I shouldn't be feeling the way I'm feeling, or I shouldn't have this reaction to the koan, you're caught, you know. And just to be able to say, oh, that's how I'm feeling, what else is going on, as she says, really restores things to something like a truer perspective and proportion. But so yeah, I think at least for me, over the years, I'm able to notice when I'm doing that a little more. And that's, you know, I'm really getting caught up in my own frustration with my own reaction to something that happened, you know, or something that I was feeling. Yeah.
I'm avoidant a lot. You know, I'm from in the Tibetan tradition, at least as far as I got, you're really into a focused awareness. So when those distracted things would come up, I would just go back to the space. Yeah. And so now that I have that habit, I'm having to work really hard to not do that and not react and just let it come by. Yeah. It's really interesting, the flow. It's the remembering part. Yeah. Because, you know, like,
exactly,
come back and I was, oh, darn, that was interesting. It just went, it's gone now.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Yeah. I think the great thing is to have an array of practices. So if somebody said, every time that material comes up, let it interrupt your concentration and never do that sort of laser-like focus, you'd lose a lot. But there must be a lot of people who are so committed to that laser-like focus that at some point they're using that as a way of fending off a lot of what it is to be who they are. I remember Joan saying about a Rinzai practice like that, you know, that in one version of it, you can have an opening, you know, you can have an enlightenment experience that's incredibly deep and about 3 inches wide. You know, that'll be very powerful, but it will be so laser-like in its focus that it will have virtually no effect on your feelings about your own actual life and your behavior in relation to other people, you know, so. So I guess we're just about out of time. Anything else before we close? Thanks again.
Thank you.